This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. The most memorable interviews and listener calls from the week that was on Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Welcome to the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Sunday edition of the Best of Fight Back. More of what you want to hear from the week that was. Do you drink alcohol? And if you do, how much do you drink? The guidelines for safe consumption were updated just over a year ago, advising Canadians that no amount of alcohol consumption is safe. And in fact, can increase risk of heart disease and cancer. Libby revisited the topic with the medical record panel on Wednesday. Dr. Malcolm Moore is a medical oncologist at Princess Margaret Cancer Center. Dr. Fahad Razak is Canada Research Chair in Data-Informed Healthcare Improvement at the University of Toronto. And Dr. Elisa Naiman is a family physician and founder and medical director of the Medical Station in Toronto.
Safe drinking guidelines are for women not more than 7 drinks in 1 week, and for men not more than 14 in a week, and not more for both genders, not more than 2 at one time. And when you go over that with people, people look at you with just such disappointment, especially women. And, you know, a couple of years ago, there was a large cohort study that came out that basically said that there's no safe amount that you can drink. It's a carcinogen, and there's no health benefit. Prior to this, we always used to say, you know, oh, go have a glass of red wine. It's good for your heart. But really now, the recommendation that I make to people is that you really should be limiting the amount that you drink, and that there really is no safe amount to drink. It can be associated with liver cancer. It can cause cirrhosis of your liver. And people need to be aware that this sort of does need to be on par with smoking. And if there is warnings that are on cigarettes, then perhaps people should be aware of that there is a risk and realize that there really is no safe amount.
What's your view of that, Fahad?
We're talking about levels of risk for those who are moderate consumers. So again, it's not the alcohol, it's the pattern of consumption. It's very clear that episodic heavier drinking, high amounts of chronic drinking, that these are associated with harms. But when you get down to the very small amounts, a half glass of wine with dinner, you know, a few days a week, I'm someone who looks at data and health outcomes, the data is just not clear. And I don't think we're going to have crystal clear evidence. And honestly, the reason why that's the case, part of it is because even if there's risk at an individual level, the risk is so incredibly small. And we have to acknowledge that a lot of what we do in society are things that are important to enjoyment of life. And part of that would be moderate consumption of alcohol with dinner or with a meal. It's part of one of the real pleasures of life for many people. What I would say to people is problematic drinking, which is binge drinking, heavier chronic consumption, the risk is so clear. And we see it on the medical side all the time. It's not just atrial fibrillation. It's cancers. It's a leading cause of death among young men. That is very clear. Very moderate consumption as part of a lifestyle, as part of social activity. My honest feeling as someone who is not a specialist in the area but cares about data is that the data showing risk for that group is very murky. And, you know, it's part of moderate consumption, part of what you consider to be enjoying your life. I think those are reasons where those are areas where I think it's very hard for us medically to step in and say, no, there's risk.
Dr. Moore, what do you think of that?
I think my worry with some of these new alcohol guidelines is, look, I've had friends who have problem drinking. I know what problem drinking looks like. Problem drinking is not drinking a glass of wine with a meal on occasion. And I think some of the new guidelines, particularly the Canadian guidelines, basically, as interpreted, would say that 80 to 85% of the population has a drinking problem. And I think in some ways it minimizes the consequences of the really severe alcohol problems that we have in our society. And I might make the analogy of driving, right? Like, driving has a risk associated with it. It's small. If you drive when you're drunk, if you drive excessively fast, if you drive while you're texting, then driving becomes dangerous. But we don't conclude from that nobody should drive because there is a small risk. It's just that you should drive appropriately. And I would say the same thing with drinking. there is a line, and when you cross that line, then you've got a problem, and that's when the health risks occur. You don't get cirrhosis from drinking a couple of drinks a week. You get cirrhosis from drinking excessive amounts every day, and I think that's where our focus needs to be.
Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at Princess Margaret Cancer Center. Dr. Fahad Rizak, Canada Research Chair in Data-Informed Healthcare Improvement at the University of Toronto, and Dr. Elisa Naiman, family physician and founder and medical director of the Medical Station in Toronto. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. We continued our focus on health Wednesday, talking about protection against pneumonia. Are you protected against pneumonia, a disease that can be very serious, even deadly, in older people? There are vaccines which can protect you, which Libby found out more on when she was joined by Dr. Jia Hu, a Calgary family physician who's also an expert in health policy, public health, and preventative medicine.
The word pneumonia itself is kind of a generic term for sort of an infection of the lung. But, you know, I think there's a specific type of bacteria, or pneumococcal bacteria, that causes not just lung infection, but also things like meningitis and sepsis. And so it can be very severe. And, you know, right now we have, broadly speaking, two vaccines available. We have a conjugate vaccine that sort of is a bit better at sort of evoking an immune response, and a polysaccharide one that's a bit older. But, you know, it is recommended in people, pretty much everybody 65 and older, actually, and many who are younger. But our uptake rates are very low in Canada.
In the past, I have to say I've had both of those vaccines. I had pneumonia. You have to take one before the other, or I don't remember the rule about it, but there is one, right?
I think that's changing now, especially as new conjugate vaccines come online. Some of these newer sort of, and the conjugate ones, the one that's a bit more, you know, protective, I'll say. And they've evolved a bit because they're covering more and more strains. And as a result, we're just saying maybe just take one of these conjugate vaccines to make things a little bit easier for the patient. One other thing to note is that, you know, many things cause pneumonia. A flu influenza causes pneumonia. You know, common colds can even cause pneumonia. And this is protecting against a specific type of bacteria that causes really bad pneumonia.
Let's talk about pneumonia and the risks of it, because and especially related to the flu for older people, the consequences of that can be really terrible. Like, it can cause death, and it causes several thousand every year, but also it can debilitate people to the point that they can no longer live independently.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you're spot on about sort of the pneumonia caused by influenza, or really any pneumonia that lands you in the hospital. I mean, every year, you know, tens of thousands of Canadians will be admitted to hospital for pneumonia. Those tend to be people who are 50 and indeed 65 and older. And even if you sort of, you know, get the pneumonia under control, it does really increase one's frailty. So one's ability to sort of go back into the way they were living before. Maybe you were living independently before, but maybe after you have the pneumonia, you need a bit of help at home, or maybe you need to move into a nursing home. That's a sort of another, you know, I'm glad you pointed out, less known consequence of these types of infections. They can really take away your independence.
And do you see a lot of that in your own practice?
Yeah, I mean, my practice does tend to be focused a bit more on younger adults. But certainly, I think that when I do see an older adult, I always want to encourage them to get all the vaccines that are recommended to them. Because anytime somebody, let's say, who's 70, 65, 80, goes in a hospital, you know, they don't, even again, you know, of course, dying is a possibility. But a lot of the times, you know, you read the discharge summaries and you know, you say, we need more care. So then you end up arranging home care, or you end up arranging long-term care. And if we can prevent those in the first place by getting these pneumonia vaccines or these flu vaccines, all the better, I think.
What are the names of the vaccines, and why do you think the uptake is so low?
Yeah, so in the sort of pneumonia world, there's a conjugate pneumonia vaccine and a polysaccharide pneumonia vaccine. And more the conjugate pneumonia vaccines, which, are essentially beginning to take over. And I think one of the brand names for the conjugate is called Prevnar, and the polysaccharide is called Pneumovax. And they're taking over because, you know, they're just a lot more effective at actually preventing pneumonia. And some of the other things, right, which is more than just pneumonia, sepsis and meningitis, really bad stuff. So it's a combination, I think, of, you know, awareness of the vaccines and then access barriers. And I think that needs to change, especially as, you know, vaccines for pneumonia or flu or RSV, shingles as well, become more and more important for the older population.
Dr. Jia Hu, a Calgary family physician and expert in health policy, public health, and preventative medicine. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up after the break, the Therma Spa Ontario Place redevelopment could cost $1 billion. We'll look at the revised numbers next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Good isn't good enough. Make way for the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. It's been a while since we heard about the controversial Therma Spa at the center of the Ontario Place redevelopment. Last year, Toronto Mayor Olivia Chow backed off her opposition to it in exchange for significant financial funding from the Ford PCs at Queen's Park. Well, this week, the main group opposing the secret deal came out with some eye-popping numbers. Members of Ontario Place for All say the total cost will end up being $1 billion, with taxpayers on the hook for $650 million, while Therma will pay a third of the billion. Libby discussed the development with our tune into the town municipal panel. Karen Stintz is CEO at Variety Village. Alex Blumenstein is co-founder of The Peak. And David Crombie is a former mayor of Toronto, among many other accomplishments.
The whole deal at Ontario Place has been shrouded in a secrecy put on by the province, which allows any figures to be used. They have a 99-year lease they're looking at. The public has never seen it. And so, and there are many other examples I could use. So Ontario Place and the people who are looking after its good fortunes are deserving every kind of difficulty they can get because they're not being square with the public.
And David, what do you think of Olivia Chow having said she's going to back off her opposition?
Yeah, I don't think she quite went that far. She said she wasn't going to press a specific thing. I think she's probably indicated that it's a provincial matter, not a municipal matter, and therefore she's not going to press forward. But I think probably they left enough ground for other people on the council to carry the ball against what is happening at Ontario Place.
Alex, what do you make of all of that?
As David said, it's a bad deal. It's a deal that's in secret, and that never works out well for taxpayers. I think that there's better use of the land there. I think that a spa could go just somewhere else. I think it's a good thing to have. I have no issue with it in itself. But it really should be in the name of the opposition group, Ontario Place for All, not a private company running some facility there. However, I do want to point out just, I think, a real hit to the credibility of this Ontario Place for All group, where their study talking about the cost and the business feasibility of this spa pointed that Hotel X also has a spa. And this is just like a basic non-understanding of what type of spas we're talking about here, where the Therm Spa is a giant spa with pools and saunas and all that. Hotel X has like massages and probably a small sauna. Like, it's not the same thing. And I thought it was a very odd piece to put forward in their opposition.
Karen, what do you think? I mean, the Conservative government, the PC government, keeps getting in trouble with certain things. And then there's the whole secrecy piece that I think really annoys people.
Yeah, you know, it's a balance, for sure. And I don't know how this is going to play out because, you know, again, this group has brought forward its audits, but I don't, you know, how those were done and whether they are actually reflective of the real costs. Again, there's a question mark there for sure. And there's no question that this group is motivated by the fact they don't want the spa there. So they're not going to release anything that would say anything except that the spa shouldn't go there and it's going to cost taxpayers money. And this is a terrible insult to the people of Ontario and to Toronto in particular. So that is what it is. But you know, and again, we are also off the heels of getting burned for the soccer.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's for sure some heightened awareness about public officials negotiating on behalf of the taxpayer for big projects that end up just putting us on the hook. That is real too. But the other challenge the government has is when they're negotiating a business deal, it's not negotiated in public. It never is. And it shouldn't be, because there's many considerations that just, and many deals that can't be done in public. But when it all breaks down, when the public loses faith that the government actually has their best interest at heart. And I think that may be where we're at right now. And that is a concern for the government that they need to address head on, in that if the public has lost the trust of the government to protect their interests, that's an issue.
It's a secret deal, but one of the key parts of it is that it's this incredibly lengthy lease, a 99-year lease, or is it a 95-year lease? Who does that, and how is it that possibly going to be in taxpayers' best interests, Alex?
I imagine the length of the lease is to reflect the investment that the spa would have to make it worthwhile, that they can't just have their, you know, prices jacked up overnight. So there's obviously a reason for that. But at the same time, we need to be getting more back for it. And that's the real issue here. We're not getting anything in return except for the right to pay to go here, the option to pay to go here.
Alex Blumenstein, co-founder of The Peak, Karen Stintz, CEO of Variety Village, and David Crombie, former mayor of Toronto. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. On Wednesday, we heard from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in his much-anticipated testimony at the public inquiry into foreign interference in the 2019 and 2021 elections. He discounted the effectiveness of Chinese election interference and questioned the reliability of intelligence by Canada's spy agency about Beijing-directed influence operations, at the same time admitting he didn't actually read the reports but relied on oral briefings. To discuss the PM's testimony, Libby was joined by Bob Richardson, Senior Counsel, National Public Relations, and Phil Gursky, President and CEO of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting and a former CSIS analyst.
I think as a former CSIS analyst, Libby, my first reaction is one of extreme disappointment that all the work that went into these assessments by my former colleagues looking into Chinese foreign interference was ignored, discounted, not trusted, listed as unreliable. You know, and the people that work in this business, they do their best to get the best intelligence to the officials that need it. We don't pretend it's the end all and the be all. And we caution, you know, the information may be of certain reliability, but for this complete dismissal, and a lot of people I've been reading are saying that, no, he's throwing CSIS under the bus. That's exactly what he's done. And I'm just disappointed as a former analyst. And I feel for my former colleagues and what that means for their morale going forward.
Bob, yes, he has thrown CSIS under the bus, but certainly he hasn't done the work himself. I mean, based on what, and what do you think of him doing that?
Yeah, I think that's a ridiculous analysis, because if you listen to the whole thing, and I did watch a lot of the testimony yesterday, first of all, he was getting briefed by the clerk of the Privy Council, his national security advisor, by his chief of staff and others on this issue. It's not like he wasn't reading the thing, threw it off of his desk and put it in a garbage can. So let's make that point clear right off the top. He was engaged on the issue. Two, this sort of stuff has been going on for 30 years or so. It's been going on during the life of his government. It went on under the life of the previous Harper government, et cetera, back. It has gotten worse in the last couple of years, and I believe Canada should act more aggressively now than it has. But Prime Minister after Prime Minister has discounted a lot of this sort of stuff because it just hasn't met the threshold of impacting our elections and also impacting our relationships with Beijing. That's the truth of the matter. Nobody likes to say it. That's the equation that they look at when they consider these various incidents.
Phil, I also was reading that Handong was told that there were questions about his conduct. He was kind of tipped off to it.
I've heard that as well, and I don't know the veracity of that, but that is the point of a busting. And yeah, I'm sure it does happen, but bust in at the cost of the People's Republic of China, which, as I said before, is not an ally of Canada, wanted to affect the elections. Whether it did or not is irrelevant. The fact is that they tried. They wanted a Liberal minority government because they felt it was better suited to their interests. The mere fact that China tried this and is being completely ignored, that's the crux to me here. It's not whether a riding fell to person A versus person B. Successive governments have ignored solid intelligence as this is happening, and that's the most egregious part for me, is that Canadians deserve to know that their elections are not being interfered with by foreign powers. And what I've seen and read the last couple of days gives me no assurances that the next election is going to be any better because the government doesn't seem to understand the importance of this issue.
Where does this leave us, Bob, this type of testimony? I mean, is this going to shut it all down?
I think this sort of conduct by the Chinese has been on the rise. And I think that is a fair comment to make. And it has been getting more explicit than it has been in the past. I think it does meet the threshold now where the government has to be more active. And this government needs to get more active on it and quite frankly, work with the opposition. This shouldn't be a partisan issue. We need to make sure our elections are free and fair and meet that threshold where people feel that it was conducted in an appropriate fashion. And if we have to take some measures now, if we have to spend some money to ensure the safety and security of our elections, we ought to be doing that. This whole process has notified us that it's been a problem, and it's been a growing problem, and we need to deal with it now.
Bob Richardson, Senior Counsel, National Public Relations, and Phil Gursky, President and CEO of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting, and a former CSIS analyst. You're listening to The Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up, what you had to say about the week that was and the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Zoomer Radio, pulling no punches with the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Fight Back with Libby Znaimer has the most informed guests on the week's hot topics. And we also rely on you for your valued opinions. Here are some of this week's best calls. Sheila in Mississauga phoned with her opinion of our Prime Minister.
He never heeds anything. When the COVID came, he was the last one to react towards closing the airport and whatever. In every instant, he's the last one to take steps. So he watches the whole world, all the leaders, what they are doing. Then he follows up. Follow the leader then.
Daryl in Toronto called with his thoughts on the anti-Israel, pro-Palestinian protests.
Regarding, you know, these protests, I think if, you know, the police went very, very easy in the city on it at the very beginning, and I don't think they should have. They should have, you know, set some kind of standards there. And I think these are going to turn into riots. If the police are doing their job properly and making these things responsible, you're going to find that these people are there not to simply protest. They're bringing their agenda here.
Stan in Mississauga called about these protests.
Sometimes I feel the police can't win. You know, they're either too strong or not strong enough. But I think the bottom line is they do have a responsibility to enforce the law. And I don't think senior Jewish people or anybody should be intimidated by any of these protests.
And now, Fight Back's Knockout Call of the Week.
There were a lot of great calls this week, but the winner of the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week is Tom in Ajax, who phoned in on Tuesday with an on-the-scene report from a protest.
I'm just leaving the beautiful downtown Whitby, where a huge, well, a fair-sized protest just rolled through there on the main street. About 30 tractor, farm tractors, cars, tractor trailers, people on the sidewalk with the mandatory F. Trudeau flag.
They are protesting what?
The carbon tax.
The carbon tax. And yeah. What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's something they feel strongly about, I guess, and the carbon tax is turning out to be somewhat of a pig in a poke, to use my old Irish grandfather's expression for something about nothing. And, it's gathering quite a bit of attention, and apparently it spoke to one of the people on the sidewalk, and they're expecting a whole bunch more people at Mark Holland's office in Ajax later, about half an hour or so.
That does it for this week's Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. If you'd like to qualify for the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week, phone us noon to one weekdays. Or if you have a comment, email us at fightback@zoomer.ca. Follow us on X at @FightbackLibby and call our Fight Back voicemail anytime at 416-367-9636. I'm Jane Brown. Join me again next weekend when we'll round up the best of Fight Back.
Best of Fight Back is produced by Jane Brown, Ziv Hadi, and Dan Christakos. Technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Neimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.